truly powers the cutting edge of manufacturing? Is it, you know, simply clever software or intricate algorithms?
Mm.
Often we overlook the mighty machines that are the physical bedrock, the ones actually building everything from precision airplane parts to, say, the intricate components of electric car batteries.
Yeah.
These are the foundational tools of industry, sometimes even called mother machines.
Indeed. Yeah. They really are the essential capital equipment upon which all advanced manufacturing is constructed. Without these incredibly sophisticated tools, the innovations and designs we talk about daily, those breakthroughs in materials and engineering,
yeah,
well, they just remain conceptual, right? They couldn't take physical form.
Exactly. And today, we're embarking on a deep dive into a company that truly exemplifies this foundational role. Nicolas Correa S.A., known on the stock market as NEAMC.
Mm.
Now, this is a Spanish industrial group you might not have heard of, but they play a crucial, often under-the-radar role in global industry. We've taken a whole stack of sources, everything from granular investment analyses to broad market reports and internal company info, to really extract the most important nuggets of knowledge here. Our mission today is to help you, the curious learner, become genuinely well-informed on this fascinating company. We'll try to uncover how this niche leader navigates complex global industrial cycles, what truly drives its impressive financial strength, and maybe what surprising facts make it stand out in, well, a highly competitive landscape. Okay, let's really unpack this then. Nicolas Correa S.A., established way back in 1947, a European leader in something quite specific, high-precision, large-format milling machines. So what exactly are these machines and why are they so profoundly crucial for the really demanding production environments around the world?
Right. Well, fundamentally, these machines are at the very heart of modern industrial production, the definition of essential capital equipment. When we call them mother machines, it's because they are the primary tools that, you know, create the parts, the components, the molds, the dies for basically everything else we use, from the smallest medical device to the largest aerospace structure.
Okay.
Nicolas Correa's specialization is in milling. Now, milling is a subtractive manufacturing process. So imagine starting with a solid block of raw material, like steel or aluminum.
Right, a solid chunk.
Exactly. A milling machine then precisely shapes that material using rotating sharp cutters that chip away the unwanted parts, leaving you with the final intricate form. What sets Correa apart is their focus on large format, meaning they can handle really big work pieces, think sections of a turbine blade or maybe a heavy truck chassis.
Yeah.
Huge. And achieving high precision, which means extreme accuracy, down to micrometers. So, for example, a bed-type machine might have the workpiece resting on a stable bed while the cutting tool moves around it. That's ideal for heavy, stable parts.
Okay.
A gantry machine, on the other hand, well, it has the cutting tool suspended from an overhead structure, like a giant bridge, right? That allows it to move over an even larger stationary workpiece. This level of precision and scale is absolutely critical for industries building the future.
So they're not just churning out any ordinary machine.
Yeah.
They're crafting these incredibly specialized, often massive pieces of equipment that demand extraordinary accuracy, extraordinary robustness.
Precisely.
That makes a lot of sense, given the industries they serve.
Yeah.
And their core business model, as I understand it, it's structured into two primary divisions, right? And they work together.
Absolutely. They're designed to be synergistic. The first is their industrial division. This is the company's core manufacturing arm. This is where the technological magic, you could say, truly happens. They design, they engineer, and they produce a really wide range of sophisticated milling machine types.
Yeah.
This includes the bed type, traveling column, gantry, bridge type models, all marketed under their well-regarded Korean-IAC brand. And it's crucial to understand, these aren't just simple tools. They are highly engineered, complex systems, really the pinnacle of mechanical and electronic integration. That sophistication is what allows for that high precision and that large format capability we talked about.
Got it. And the second division?
The second and equally critical part of their model is their commercial division. Now, while this division manages their extensive global distribution network, it's genius, really, and what makes it truly strategic lies in providing the higher margin after-sales services, things like technical advisory, ongoing maintenance.
That's service side.
Exactly. And the service component is absolutely foundational to their long-term success because, get this, Nicolas Correa has an extensive global installed base of over 5,400 machines currently operating around the world.
5,400. That's a lot of machines out there.
It is. To give you some context, that includes more than 3,500 of their powerful bed-type machines and over 1,000 floor-type machines.
Wow. So this huge installed base, it's clearly not just a number on a page, right? Mm. How does that actually translate into a, you know, a steady, less cyclical revenue stream, especially when selling big machines must be inherently lumpy?
That's a fantastic question, and it's where the strategic brilliance of their model, often called servitization in the industry, really shines. This extensive installed base creates a dedicated, almost captive market for recurring revenue. Think about it. Once a customer invests millions in one of their high-precision machines, they are heavily, heavily incentivized to rely on the original manufacturer.
Not on Korea, yeah.
On Korea, for ongoing maintenance, for necessary spare parts, crucial machine upgrades, just to ensure optimal performance, longevity, and frankly, to protect their initial huge investment.
Right. You wouldn't take your Formula One car to just any garage.
Exactly. So this stream of predictable, recurring revenue from services significantly de-risks the entire business model. It's like moving from a purely transactional big sale model to a more stable, recurring, almost razor and blades kind of revenue stream.
Mm. Interesting analogy.
And in a notoriously cyclical industry like capital equipment, having a substantial and growing stream of stable, higher margin revenue acts as a crucial buffer. It helps maintain cash flow even when new machine sales might slow down during, say, an economic downturn. It makes the entire business far more resilient through those cycles. This symbiotic relationship between new machine sales and the robust service division is a real structural advantage. It truly enhances the quality and predictability of their cash flows. We should also probably mention their subsidiary, NC Service. They specifically focus on retrofitting and selling secondhand Korea and ENIAC brand machines.
Extending the life cycle.
Exactly. It extends their market reach even further and deepens customer engagement across the entire life cycle of their products. It shows a really holistic approach to their customer relationships.
That's a compelling point, especially for those high-precision sectors like aerospace you mentioned. It really does sound like they sell you the high-performance race car, and then they're the only ones who can truly tune it, maintain it, keep it performing at peak for decades, creates a long-term, high-value relationship.
That's a great way to put it.
Now, looking at where they sell these sophisticated machines, it's clear they're not just serving their local Spanish market.
Oh, not at all. Nicolas Correa is fundamentally an export-driven enterprise. This is perhaps their most defining characteristic, really. Exports consistently account for about 90% of their total revenue. It actually reached 91.9% in 2023.
90%? Wow.
Yeah. This heavy international focus means the company is effectively a pure play on global industrial health and the broader capital expenditure cycles of manufacturers worldwide. Their sales are primarily concentrated in major industrial blocks. The European Union is their main market, consistently accounting for roughly 60-65% of sales. Germany, historically, has been a particularly significant contributor within the EU.
Okay, so Europe is key.
Very key. Then China stands as their next most important single market, representing about 23% of their sales. And to support this expansive global presence, they maintain a network of direct subsidiaries in key markets like Germany, China, and the United States. This ensures direct customer contact, rapid response times, and crucial localized service capabilities.
So given that, what, roughly two-thirds of their sales are in Europe and nearly a quarter in China, that means if the industrial sectors in those specific regions face headwinds, Nicolas Correa is going to feel that impact quite directly.
Precisely. And while recent performance data shows a bit of a dynamic mix, you know, strong growth in markets like Turkey and Canada, contrasting with the decline in Germany and sort of flat performance in China, which reflects the shifting global macroeconomic conditions, this heavy reliance on foreign markets is, as you said, a double-edged sword. Oh. It certainly provides access to a vast addressable market way beyond what Spain alone could offer. But it also exposes the company to significant geopolitical risks, the impact of changing trade policies, tariffs, and foreign exchange volatility. These are things largely beyond their immediate control.
Yeah, makes sense.
It makes their ability to diversify and adapt even more critical for long-term stability.
And what about the types of industries that rely on these mother machines? I imagine it's not just one sector. Do they have a reasonably diversified customer base?
They absolutely do. Nicolas Correa serves a diverse portfolio of high-value, typically cyclical end markets. Their machines are critical components throughout the manufacturing value chains of sectors like aerospace.
Precision is paramount there.
Absolutely, for flight safety. Then automotive, particularly with the huge shift to electric vehicles and the need for totally new production lines. Railway, for components in modern train systems. wind energy, requiring large machines for turbine components.
Big parts.
Very big parts. General capital goods production across various industries and broader energy sectors, too. It's also notable that they have exposure to the defense industry. That's a sector with its own distinct spending cycles and extremely high technical requirements, you know, given the mission-critical nature of the parts.
Right.
This strategic diversification across these high-value industries provides a crucial degree of resilience. It helps mitigate the impact of a downturn in any single industry. If one sector pulls back, others might still be investing. They really occupy a vital role as a high-end capital goods provider, supplying machines essential for advanced manufacturing across these critical sectors.
Okay, you've really highlighted the importance of that service component in smoothing out the cycles. That sounds like a powerful operational advantage. But to truly grasp their competitive landscape, we probably need to zoom out a bit and understand the broader forces at play in the machine tool industry itself. What does that global market look like? What are its biggest drivers and maybe its biggest challenges?
Right. Context is key. The global machine tool market is, well, it's truly immense. It forms the very industrial backbone of modern economies. Estimates for its sheer size in 2023-2024 generally range somewhere between $98 billion and $121 billion U.S. dollars.
Huge.
It's huge. And the projections for the coming years are quite robust. Consensus forecasts point to a compound annual growth rate, a CAGR, of between 7.0% and 9.5% through maybe 2030-2033. Now, Nicolas Correa specifically specializes in the milling machine subsegment. That itself is a very significant market, valued at approximately $76 billion in 2024, and it's expected to grow at a CAGR of around 5.2%.
Still very substantial.
Very. Geographically, Asia-Pacific accounts for over half of global machine tool consumption, with China, as we mentioned, standing out as the single largest market.
So it's a massive industrial pie, and Nicolas Correa operates within a substantial growing slice of it. What are the major sort of long-term trends that are pushing this kind of consistent growth across the whole industry?
Yeah, there are several really powerful secular tailwinds providing significant structural momentum here. The first one, and perhaps the most profound, is automation and digitalization, often broadly referred to as Industry 4.0.
Industry 4.0, right.
This represents a deep transformation happening in manufacturing globally. There's an accelerating demand for smarter, more flexible, highly automated production solutions. We're seeing the deep integration of computer numerical control, CNC technology, the Internet of Things, IoT for machine-to-machine communication, artificial intelligence, AI for process optimization, digital twins for virtual prototyping.
All the buzzwords, but they mean real changes.
They mean real changes. All aimed at dramatically improving precision, enhancing efficiency, and significantly reducing downtime in production lines. The CNC segment alone, which is fundamental to Correa's machines, is forecast to grow at over a 7-8% CAGR. That underscores its huge importance. To give you an analogy, think of how smartphones completely revolutionized communication by making devices smarter, more interconnected. Industry 4.0 is doing precisely the same thing for factories, making them intelligent, responsive, far more productive.
That's a great analogy. Factories literally becoming more connected and intelligent systems. What other big macro trends are driving this demand?
Another significant trend, one that's gained a lot of traction recently, is manufacturing reshoring and nearshoring.
Bias, bringing production back home.
Exactly. We've seen this extensively in the news over the past few years. Geopolitical tensions, those persistent logistical bottlenecks that emerged during the pandemic, rising transport costs. It's all prompted companies to fundamentally rethink the resilience and geographic spread of their global supply chains.
Makes sense.
So as a result, many multinational corporations are actively bringing manufacturing operations closer to their home markets, whether that's the U.S., Europe, or other nearby regions, primarily to improve supply chain resilience and mitigate various risks. This trend directly stimulates significant new domestic investment in advanced machine tools because new factories need to be built, existing ones need to be modernized.
Right.
This creates a very tangible and direct demand driver for regional manufacturers like Nicolas Correa. If you follow news about supply chain disruptions, this trend directly impacts companies like Correa. They provide the essential tools for rebuilding and strengthening domestic manufacturing capabilities.
So it's a shift driven by worries about security and resilience, not just pure cost anymore. And I imagine precision is always a factor, right? Especially with new materials and cutting-edge tech coming online.
Absolutely. There's an ever-increasing demand for precision across a diverse range of industries. Sectors like aerospace, where components must meet essentially zero-defect standards for safety. Medical devices, needing microscopic accuracy. And especially the rapidly evolving automotive sector, with its monumental shift to EVs.
EVs need different parts, different processes.
Totally different. All require components with ever-increasing complexity and extremely tight manufacturing tolerances. This stringent demand for intricate parts, flawless finishes, it can only be met by technologically advanced high-precision machine tools. It forces manufacturers across these industries to continually upgrade their capital equipment just to stay competitive, meet regulations, and cater to the evolving demands of their products. It's a relentless push for higher quality, tighter specs.
That sounds like a really powerful confluence of long-term drivers pushing things forward. But you mentioned earlier that despite these tailwinds, the industry is still inherently cyclical. What specifically makes it so, and what are the key demand drivers that dictate these ups and downs?
You're right to highlight the inherent cyclicality. It's unavoidable. The machine tool industry is inextricably tied to broader manufacturing capital expenditure CapEx cycles. When the global economy feels robust, businesses are confident about future demand. They invest heavily in new machinery, expand capacity, upgrade technology.
Makes sense. Buy when times are good.
Exactly. Conversely, when there's economic uncertainty, maybe rising interest rates or a general slowdown, these large, often discretionary investments are frequently delayed or even canceled. That directly impacts machine tool orders. Key demand drivers, which fluctuate with these cycles, include the automotive sector. It remains the single largest end market, accounting for over 40% of global machine tool demand. And that structural shift toward EVs is particularly potent here. It necessitates entirely new production lines, retooling for different materials, unique assembly processes for things like battery trays, motor casings.
A huge tooling change.
Massive.
Mm.
Then there's aerospace and defense, a critical source of demand for the high-precision, multi-axis machines that Correa specializes in. Right now, we're seeing surging demand in commercial aviation, record order backlogs as global travel rebounds. And global defense spending also continues to climb due to geopolitical factors.
Okay.
Lastly, the energy sector. That includes both traditional oil and gas infrastructure and the rapidly growing renewable energy segment. Both require large, robust machine tools for producing components like wind turbine hubs, generator shafts, specialized drilling equipment.
So, healthy auto sector, booming aerospace, and growing energy demand all broadly bode well for the industry. But what about the immediate picture, the more challenging landscape right now? Are there any significant headwinds we should be aware of?
Yes, the industry, particularly in Europe, where Nicolas Correa has, as we noted, significant exposure, is indeed facing some noticeable near-term headwinds. The European Association of Manufacturing Technologies, CESIMO, they've reported a challenging environment, specifically noting a 7.5% decline in European machine tool production in 2024. And they're forecasting an additional 7.5% drop in 2025.
Ouch, back-to-back declines.
Yeah, it's significant. This downturn is attributed to a confluence of factors. Persistent geopolitical tensions, broad market uncertainty, and just a general economic slowdown affecting the broader European economy. Furthermore, the high initial capital investment required for advanced machinery can itself restrain growth, especially during periods of elevated economic uncertainty or for smaller companies that might struggle to access capital. What's truly fascinating here, though, is this dual narrative, isn't it? On one hand, you have these incredibly powerful long-term tailwinds like Industry 4.0, reshoring, the demand for precision, all driving the industry forward.
Right. The long-term looks bright.
But on the other hand, there are significant near-term cyclical pressures, particularly that slowdown in Europe, which is a really key market for Correa. This juxtaposition raises a critical question. How does a company like Nicolas Correa strategically position itself to capture those powerful long-term opportunities while simultaneously navigating and mitigating these immediate economic headwinds?
That really is the challenge, isn't it? So it's a massive and dynamic market, but also, as you've laid out, a highly competitive one.
Mm-hmm.
How does a company like Nicolas Correa, which isn't one of the absolute global behemoths, compete effectively against these huge players?
Yeah.
What's their unique selling proposition, their secret sauce that allows them to thrive?
Right. That's the crux of their competitive positioning, and it really underscores their strength. The market for milling machines is quite fragmented, you know, characterized by distinct tiers of competitors. On one end, you have the global diversified leaders. Think Germany's Trumpf, DMG, MORI, or Japan's Yamazaki Mazak, Okuma. These are typically massive corporations with vast product portfolios covering many machine types, extensive global sales and service networks, huge scale.
The giants.
Then you have direct European peers. Fellow Spanish manufacturer Zaire S.A., Italy's PMSPA, which, interestingly, was just acquired by Japan's Nidec Corporation, a huge industrial player.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and Germany's Waldrich Coburg. These are more direct competitors in that large format, high precision milling space. In the U.S., you'd find players like Haas Automation, known maybe more for affordability and user-friendliness than smaller to medium machines, and MAG. And of course, there are the Asian competitors like Huaxian from South Korea and various large Chinese manufacturers who often compete very aggressively on price, particularly in the more standardized machine segments.
Okay, that's a truly crowded and diverse field. So how does Nicolas Correa carve out its niche and stand out against such formidable giants on one side and maybe nimble, price-focused, smaller players on the other?
Their strategy is really built on focused differentiation. And their most significant advantage, hands down, lies in technological differentiation, specifically in their proprietary milling heads. A prime example, and it's a truly remarkable piece of engineering, is their award-winning UDX milling head. It even earned an IF Design Award back in 2018, which is a pretty prestigious international design accolade.
Okay, the UDX head, what's so special about it?
What makes it special and why it's a competitive moat is its unique double hearth coupling system. Nicolas Correa holds a worldwide patent on this.
Patented.
This innovative design allows for, well, unprecedented flexibility and precision. To give you some context, it can achieve spindle speeds of 10,000 revolutions per minute, RPM. Very fast. And rotation indexing every 0.02 degrees. Now, 0.02 degrees might sound like a tiny number, but it means they can orient the cutting tool with incredibly fine, almost microscopic detail. Imagine adjusting a laser pointer on a target miles away with millimeter accuracy.
Incredible precision.
Exactly. This allows for the machining of extremely complex geometries and achieving unparalleled surface finishes. This deep focus on a critical high-performance component delivers capabilities that are incredibly difficult for competitors, especially the lower-cost ones, to replicate without infringing on their patent or, you know, investing decades in R&D. It's truly their signature piece of engineering, a cornerstone of their value proposition.
So they've perfected this critical patented component that gives them a distinct edge. What else contributes to their competitive strength? It can't just be the head, right?
No, you're right. Beyond the cutting-edge technology, brand reputation and quality are absolutely paramount in the high-value capital goods sector. The Correa brand has been meticulously built over decades and is widely associated with robustness, reliability, and precision.
Trust is key when you're spending millions.
Absolutely. And they reinforce this reputation with a very tangible commitment. They offer a 5-year warranty on their entire range of machines. That's a powerful statement of confidence in their quality and, frankly, quite rare in this industry.
5 years, yeah, that's significant.
It is. For customers in high-stakes sectors like aerospace or defense, where precision and reliability are non-negotiable for safety and performance, that brand trust is a key purchasing factor. And finally, their niche focus is a strength in itself. Unlike the global giants who spread their resources across a vast array of machine types, Nicolas Correa maintains a tight focus specifically on milling solutions.
So they stick to what they know best.
Exactly. This allows them to cultivate deeper engineering expertise, intimately understand the nuanced needs of their milling customers, and offer highly tailored product solutions that broader competitors, just by their nature, might struggle to match. It's a strategy of mastery over breadth.
That makes a lot of sense. Specialization often leads to mastery, as you said. Are there significant barriers for new players trying to get into this highly specialized segment of the machine tool market? Can someone just jump in?
Oh, absolutely not easily. The barriers to entry in this specific high-precision machine tool segment are substantial. It makes it really difficult for new entrants to gain any meaningful traction. You're looking at requiring significant upfront capital investment. You need advanced manufacturing facilities, state-of-the-art R&D capabilities, a global sales and service network. That's a huge cost.
Big bucks up front.
Big bucks. Beyond that, there's a need for deep, specialized technological know-how that honestly takes decades to cultivate and perfect. New companies also face the challenge of building long-standing customer relationships and an established brand reputation. Both are critical for persuading a customer to make a multi-million euro investment in foundational capital equipment. These aren't easy obstacles to overcome quickly.
Right. You don't build that trust overnight. And you mentioned an interesting recent development in the competitive landscape that sort of highlights the value of companies like Nicolas Correa.
Yes. That 2023 acquisition of their Italian peer PAMA by Nidec Corporation, that very large Japanese industrial giant, is quite telling. This transaction serves as a strong validation, really, of the strategic value of specialized European high-precision machine tool manufacturers. It clearly shows that large global players, like Nidec, see significant value in acquiring niche expertise and established market positions, like PAMA's, and by extension, like Nicolas Correa's. This development has dual implications for Correa. On one hand, it creates a potentially more formidable competitor in PAMA, now backed by Nidec's immense global scale and financial resources.
More competition.
Potentially tougher competition. But on the other hand, it also subtly highlights Nicolas Correa itself as a potentially attractive acquisition target for another industrial conglomerate looking to gain a foothold or expand their presence in this valuable high-precision market segment. It kind of puts a spotlight on the underlying intrinsic value of these specialized businesses.
So it's really not about being the biggest player overall, but rather about being the most technologically advanced and the most trusted within their specific high-value niche. That UDX head really sounds like a remarkable piece of engineering that underpins their competitive edge.
Yeah, absolutely. If we connect this to the bigger picture, it profoundly underscores that even in a highly competitive global industrial landscape, a focused differentiation strategy built on proprietary patented technology and an ironclad reputation for quality can create a robust and highly defensible competitive moat. This is absolutely essential for understanding why Nicolas Correa can command a premium for their machines and their services, and why they maintain a leadership position despite their relatively smaller scale compared to some of those sprawling global giants in the broader machine tool industry. This distinction is what allows them to generate those superior financial returns we're about to talk about.
Okay, now that we truly understand their business, their market, how they differentiate themselves competitively, let's finally turn to the numbers. Because, you know, at the end of the day, a strong strategy needs to translate into demonstrably strong financial performance. And the sources suggest Nicolas Correa has a rare and remarkably attractive financial profile for a company in this sector.
Indeed, their financial profile is quite impressive, especially when you consider, as you said, it's a cyclical industrial business operating in a capital-intensive sector. Looking at their historical performance, say from 2019 through 2023, they've shown a consistently strong growth trajectory. They successfully navigated the post-pandemic recovery, supply chain disruptions, a period of high inflation quite a bit.
Yeah, turbulent times.
Turbulent times. Their revenue grew from $74.0 million in 2019 to $109.9 million in 2023. That translates to a compound annual growth rate, a CAGR, of 10.4% over that period. EBITDA, which is a key measure of operational profitability before, you know, non-cash items, also saw robust growth. It increased from $9.7 million to $14.1 million, representing a 9.8% CAGR.
Solid growth.
Solid growth. And their net profit grew from $8.2 million to $10.9 million, a healthy 7.4% CAGR. And this strong momentum has continued into 2024. They had record turnover and profit figures for 2023, setting a high bar. And their first half 2024 results showed a further 20% increase in revenue and a substantial 39% surge in EBITDA year over year.
39% jump in EBITDA. That's significant. So those are certainly robust growth numbers for an industrial company. But what about their margins? Are they just growing revenue or are they actually growing it profitably, making more money on each fail?
That's where their financial story becomes particularly compelling and truly stands out from the crowd. A defining feature of Nicolas Correa's financial profile is its superior profitability, especially evident in its EBITDA margin. This margin reached 12.8% in 2023, and it's actually forecast to expand even further, projecting to 14-15% in 2024.
14-15%.
Yeah. And crucially, this level of profitability is approximately 4-5 percentage points higher than the average of its industry peers.
4-5 points higher. That's not trivial.
No, it isn't just a slight edge. It indicates a significant and likely durable competitive advantage. This superior margin is a direct reflection of their pricing power, stemming from that strong brand reputation, their technologically differentiated products like the UDX head, and rigorous cost control. The fact that their EBITDA is growing at an outsized rate relative to their revenue, that 39% jump you noted versus 20% revenue growth, points to strong operational leverage.
Okay, explain operational leverage quickly.
Sure. Basically, it means as revenue grows, their profits grow even faster. This leverage is driven by operating at 100% production capacity, having a favorable product mix skewed towards higher value, more complex machines, and disciplined cost management. The ability to expand margins despite inflationary pressures on salaries and raw materials provides really compelling evidence of that robust pricing power and operational efficiency.
So they're not merely generating more revenue. They're generating significantly more profit from every euro of revenue compared to their competitors. That's a powerful combination for any business. And what about their balance sheet? We hear about companies loaded with debt. Is theirs as strong and resilient as their operations suggest?
The balance sheet. This is perhaps the most impressive aspect of their financial strength, especially for a company in a capital-intensive and cyclical sector. Financial analysts would probably describe it as a fortress balance sheet.
Fortress.
Hmm. Unlike many of their peers who often carry substantial debt to fund operations and growth, Nicholas Korea operates with a negative net debt position.
Negative net debt, meaning more cash than debt.
Exactly. They actually have more cash on hand than they have total debt. Specifically, they reported a consolidated net cash position of $11.7 million at the end of 2023, and that figure grew even further to approximately $19 million by mid-2024.
$19 million in net cash.
Yeah. Their debt-to-equity ratio, which measures how much debt a company uses relative to shareholder equity, is extremely low, just 0.06x.
Wow, practically no leverage from debt.
Almost none. It means for every dollar of assets financed by ownership, they have only about 6 cents financed by debt. It's a remarkably safe and conservative financial structure.
Yeah.
And this financial prudence provides immense flexibility and strategic optionality that most of their competitors simply don't possess.
How so?
Well, it allows them to weather economic downturns with far greater resilience than leveraged competitors. They can continue investing aggressively in crucial R&D and strategic projects through the economic cycles when others might have to pull back.
Right, they can play offense when others are playing defense. Precisely. And they can fund ambitious expansion plans without relying on external, often expensive financing. It fundamentally de-risks their investment profile. Imagine a highly successful business that not only generates impressive profits, but also has a massive cash reserve. It makes them incredibly resilient and agile compared to competitors loaded with debt. They can pounce on opportunities when others are struggling. It's a true competitive weapon.
That's an incredibly strong and, frankly, enviable position to be in. No need to borrow money for growth, no existential worries about surviving a downturn. And what about their ability to convert those impressive profits into actual tangible cash, cash that can be reinvested or returned to shareholders?
They have a proven and consistent ability to generate strong cash flow. Their price-to-free cash flow, or PFCF ratio, is around 12x, which generally indicates a healthy conversion of their profits into real, usable cash. They also demonstrate highly efficient working capital management. For example, they've steadily reduced their average supplier payment period from 58 days back in 2019 to just 52 days in 2023.
Seems like a small detail, but important.
It is important. It showcases disciplined operational execution and contributes directly to that robust cash position by optimizing their cash conversion cycle, how quickly they turn operations into cash. This whole financial profile is truly quite remarkable for a cyclical industrial business. We're seeing high growth, industry-leading profitability, and critically, that net cash balance sheet. It speaks volumes about the management's financial discipline and the inherent quality and resilience of their underlying business model. Given this impressive financial strength, it naturally raises a very important question for you, the learner.
Right.
How exactly are they planning to deploy this financial firepower for future growth? And what does that mean for you as a potential shareholder?
So Nicholas Correa has clearly built this incredibly strong financial foundation. What is the strategic plan for the future then? How are they thinking about expanding? What are their big investment priorities?
Right.
And how do they balance this ambitious growth with, you know, returning value to their shareholders?
Right. Management has articulated a very clear and ambitious strategic vision. They are actively building what they call the factory of the future. Now, this isn't merely about incremental increasing production output. It involves a fundamental modernization and significant expansion of the company's entire manufacturing footprint.
Okay, a major overhaul.
Pretty much. They've initiated substantial investments aimed at enhancing manufacturing efficiency, think automation, digital integration, and crucially, expanding their assembly capacity. The long-term objective here seems twofold. Solidify their technological leadership in the market and protect that superior margin structure we discussed earlier by ensuring they remain at the absolute cutting edge of production technology.
So a significant and comprehensive upgrade to their core production capabilities. What are the specific organic growth initiatives that are driving this ambitious investment? What are they actually spending on?
The primary organic driver is capacity expansion. As we noted, Nicolas Correa reported operating at 100% capacity utilization in 2024. That's a direct consequence of their impressive record order backlog, which stood at $107.7 million at the close of 2023.
They literally couldn't build machines fast enough.
Pretty much. So to meet the sustained future demand and deliver on those orders, they've launched a significant capital expenditure CapEx program. It's happening at their headquarters in Burgos, Spain, and across their key industrial subsidiaries. This program is expected to be completed in the second half of 2025. Now, for you, the listener, this investment is absolutely essential to meet the strong demand they're seeing and to fuel future growth.
But
it also introduces near-term execution risk, as with any large-scale project. You know, potential delays, cost overruns, or even the risk of temporary underutilization if demand were to unexpectedly slow down right after the expansion is finished. So it's a critical area to watch closely.
Okay, definitely something to monitor. It's certainly encouraging, though, to see them investing so aggressively in their future capacity. But beyond just making more machines, are they still pushing the boundaries of technology and innovation? Is R&D still a focus?
Oh, absolutely. R&D and innovation are deeply embedded in the core of their value proposition. They see it as vital for maintaining their competitive edge. They boast a long and successful history of R&D, actively participating in significant European and Spanish research projects. Their innovation pipeline is sharply focused on key future trends in manufacturing.
Like what specifically?
Well, for instance, they're heavily invested in digitalization, exemplified by their Mill IoT project. That aims to develop fully connected Industry 4.0 machines capable of real-time data exchange. They're also focusing on proactive and predictive maintenance services, using data to anticipate machine needs before a failure occurs. That's huge value for customers.
Definitely. Less downtime.
Exactly. And they're pioneering eco-design principles, aiming to reduce the environmental impact and energy consumption of their machines throughout their life cycle. This continuous investment in R&D isn't just about adding new features. It's vital for maintaining their technological edge, ensuring their products remain relevant in a rapidly evolving industrial landscape, and, crucially, for sustaining that pricing power we keep coming back to.
And I understand they're making a pretty significant strategic move internationally as well, looking beyond their traditional European and Chinese markets.
Yes, this is a cornerstone of their long-term growth strategy, diversifying their geographic footprint by placing a clear and deliberate focus on high-growth emerging markets. The most significant recent initiative here is their strategic pivot to India. In early 2025, they are launching a new 1.5 million state-of-the-art facility in Pune, India.
Pune, okay. Why India?
Well, this isn't just a sales office. It's envisioned as a strategic hub for after-sales service for the entire Southeast Asia region, excluding China. The goal is faster service, better access to spare parts, more direct customer support in a really vital, fast-growing market. Management has explicitly identified India as a crucial market for their future, and they are openly exploring the potential for establishing a full-fledged production facility there eventually, and even expressing openness to strategic partnerships or joint ventures.
So a big bet on India's growth.
It's a crucial and exceptionally well-timed strategic decision, I think. It allows them to tap into one of the world's fastest-growing manufacturing markets, and simultaneously it serves to reduce their reliance on the more mature and currently cyclically challenged European and Chinese markets.
So it's growth and de-risking.
Exactly. It's a significant de-risking move that also opens up substantial new avenues for long-term growth.
That makes a lot of strategic sense, proactively spreading their bets into new high-growth areas to build resilience and find new revenue streams. And how are they tying all of these growth initiatives, the capacity, the R&D, the India move-in, to that broader digitalization trend, Industry 4.0?
They are very actively embracing Industry 4.0 and the broader trend of digitalization. Nicolas Correa is an active participant in their regional government's Smart Specialization Strategy, RIS3, which is a public-private initiative aimed at fostering innovation. Their R&D director has publicly emphasized the critical importance of adapting their design, production, and distribution models to fully integrate into the digital economy.
So they're thinking beyond just the hardware.
Absolutely. This strategic focus on developing connected machines and leveraging data-driven insights presents a significant opportunity to build upon their already strong after-sales business. They aim to create new, high-margin, recurring revenue streams from advanced software solutions, real-time analytics, sophisticated predictive maintenance services. It's the practical application of servitization in the digital age. It transforms how they interact with their machines and customers long after the initial sale.
Okay, so they're investing heavily across the board in capacity, R&D, new markets like India, digitalization. How does this ambitious growth strategy balance with their commitment to returning value to shareholders? Are they pouring everything back into the business?
Their approach to capital allocation seems both disciplined and balanced. In the near to medium term, their primary focus is clearly on those elevated capital expenditure investments for organic growth. That makes sense with 100% capacity utilization and a record order backlog. Management's clear preference is to reinvest in their core business when these high return opportunities are identified.
Reinvesting makes sense if the returns are good.
Exactly. And they employ a very capital efficient R&D model too. Instead of solely funding all research internally, they actively participate in publicly co-funded research consortia like RACE3, MIL-IoT, CNET. This allows them to leverage external funding and partner expertise, which helps protect their margins even while they're innovating heavily.
Smart way to stretch the R&D budget.
Very smart. But despite these significant investments, they maintain a strong track record of growing dividends to shareholders. Their dividend per share has grown from 0.17 back in 2021 to a proposed 0.30 for 2025. That represents an impressive compound annual growth rate of over 15%.
15% dividend growth, that's pretty strong.
It is, and they target a sustainable payout ratio of approximately 30% of net profit. That's meaningful for investors, yet conservative enough to be sustainable through various economic cycles. They don't appear to have a significant share repurchase program. The focus seems to be on that consistent cash dividend growth. And the effectiveness of this balanced strategy is really validated by their strong returns on capital. Their trailing 12-month return on invested capital, ROIC, was 11.72%, and return on capital employed, ROCE, was 17.66%. Analyst projections suggest that their ROCE will remain robust around 17-18% even after the big expansion. That indicates these investments are highly accretive and well above their cost of capital. They're creating real value.
Right.
What's particularly fascinating here, I think, is that strategic pivot to India. It's not just about adding another sales region. It's a significant, well-timed, de-risking move that opens up a vital new avenue for growth, especially given the current European headwinds. If we connect this to the bigger picture, it shows a very deliberate and thoughtful strategy. Balancing ambitious organic growth through significant investments with disciplined capital deployment and a clear, consistent commitment to growing shareholder returns. It speaks to a real long-term vision.
Okay, behind every successful company, especially one with such a strong legacy and these ambitious plans, there's usually a strong leadership team. What's the story behind Nicolas Correia's management? And just as importantly, what are the big challenges and risks that could potentially derail their otherwise impressive trajectory?
Right. Management quality is crucial. At Nicolas Correia, it's undoubtedly a significant factor in their consistent success. The leadership team combines deep industry experience with a long-term perspective, which is absolutely vital in a cyclical capital goods business like this. They are led by CEO Maria del Carmen Pinto Fuentes, who works closely alongside members of the founding Nicolas Correia family. And recently, in May 2024, there were key appointments. Bibiana Nicolas Correia Vilches took on the role of president, and Jaime Nicolas Correia Vilches became vice president.
Ah, family succession.
Exactly. These appointments clearly signal a well-defined family succession plan, ensuring continuity of the strategic vision and the company's established corporate culture. And their execution track record under this leadership is truly impressive. They've successfully guided the company to record revenue and profit figures, effectively managed high inflation by not only maintaining but actually expanding margins, and maintained that pristine, fortress-like balance sheet we discussed earlier.
So it's a seasoned team with a clear succession plan for the future. What about the ownership structure itself? That can often tell you a lot about the alignment of interests within a company.
This is indeed a defining feature of their corporate governance and a crucial point for you to understand. The promoter group, which primarily includes the founding family and key executives, holds a controlling stake of approximately 44.6% of the company's shares.
Almost half the company.
Yeah. The Nicolas Correia family itself holds a significant 29.01% stake, and the CEO holds about 1.19%. This substantial insider ownership creates a powerful alignment of interest between the management, the founding family, and all other shareholders. Their personal wealth is directly tied to the long-term performance and sustainable value creation of the company's stock.
Skin in the game.
Lots of skin in the game. It strongly incentivizes a focus on enduring growth rather than, say, short-term financial engineering. It's very likely a key factor behind their disciplined capital allocation strategy and their very conservative balance sheet management.
But is there a downside to that concentration?
Well, as you consider this, it's also worth noting that such a concentrated holding can potentially reduce the influence of minority shareholders in certain key corporate decisions. And it might, in some cases, raise concerns about management entrenchment. It's a trade-off that often comes with high insider ownership.
Okay, fair point.
Yeah.
And how transparent are they, particularly regarding things like executive compensation and financial reporting?
Executive compensation at Nicolas Correa appears structured to further reinforce that shareholder alignment. The reported cash salaries are quite modest, actually. The CEO's compensation, for instance, was listed at approximately $76,000 earned.
Modest for a CEO?
Relatively modest, yes. This cash component is supplemented by a share delivery plan for the managing director, which directly links a portion of her remuneration to the performance of the company's shares. This emphasizes wealth creation through long-term equity appreciation. In terms of transparency, they maintain regular financial updates through their investor relations department and public filings. And their annual reports consistently receive unqualified audit opinions from Ernst & Young, which indicates high standards of financial reporting and a commitment to accuracy.
So a well-aligned, experienced, and transparent team guiding the ship. But every business, no matter how well managed, faces inherent risks. What are the big challenges and potential headwinds for Nicolas Correa that you should really be aware of?
Right. No company is immune to risk. The primary and most significant one, as we touched on earlier, is their inherent business and cyclical exposure. Nicolas Correa has high exposure to the global manufacturing capital expenditure cycle. Their revenues are directly linked to their customers' willingness to make large discretionary investments in new machinery.
When belts tighten, big machines are often the first things cut.
Exactly. A significant or prolonged slowdown in their key end markets would directly impact their order intake. And this risk is particularly acute given their geographic concentration. Approximately 65% of their sales currently come from Europe. This makes them highly vulnerable to the current industrial slowdown there. Remember, the European Machine Tool Association, CSMO, forecasted those sharp 7.5% declines in European production for both 2024 and 2025.
That's a very tangible, immediate headwind.
Very tangible. While their record order backlog provides a strong buffer for 2024 and ensures revenue visibility for the current year, a prolonged or deeper European recession could severely impact order intake for 2025 and beyond. That's the big one to watch.
Okay, so the macro cycle, especially in Europe, is risk number one. What about competitive risks in such a crowded market?
They certainly operate in a fiercely competitive industry, facing competitive risks from multiple fronts. There's constant pressure from those global leaders like DMG, MORI, and Yamazaki Mazak. They possess far greater financial resources, broader product portfolios, more extensive global reach.
It's a scale advantage.
Then there's the ever-present threat from Asian low-cost competitors who can aggressively undercut prices, particularly in more standardized segments, potentially eroding margins. And of course, the risk of technological disruption is always present. A competitor could develop a fundamentally superior milling technology, or maybe an entirely disruptive new manufacturing process could emerge that erodes Nicolas Correa's niche advantage if they don't continuously innovate. They have to stay ahead.
Right. Complacency is death in tech. Are there any other operational or financial risks that stand out?
Yes, there are a few others worth mentioning. Firstly, execution risk related to that major CapEx program for capacity expansion. While necessary for growth, successful, on-time, and on-budget execution is absolutely critical. Any significant delays or cost overruns could negatively impact their financials and investor confidence.
Big projects have big risks.
They do. Secondly, they face foreign exchange exposure. With about 90% of their revenue derived from exports, strong fluctuations in currency rates, especially a strengthening euro, could impact their competitiveness in international markets or reduce their translated profits when converting foreign currency sales back into euros.
The currency roller coaster.
Exactly. Thirdly, margin sustainability is always a factor to watch. While their current margins are remarkably high, they could come under pressure in a severe cyclical downturn that forces aggressive price competition, or if inflationary pressures on raw materials and labor costs outpace their ability to implement price increases.
Keeping those high margins isn't guaranteed.
Not guaranteed, especially in a downturn. Finally, like any global capital goods provider, they have an inherent macroeconomic and geopolitical sensitivity. Rising global interest rates, broader geopolitical instability, trade tariffs or protectionist policies, all these can dampen industrial investment and lead to delayed or even canceled orders for their high-value machines.
Lots of external factors. Yeah.
This comprehensive view of their risks raises an important question for you, the learner. While that strong insider ownership certainly creates powerful alignment with long-term interests, it also means you, as a minority shareholder, are placing significant trust in the family's long-term vision and execution. And while they have a robust backlog providing near-term security, that forecasted European industrial slowdown is a very tangible, immediate headwind they must navigate successfully. How much do these risks weigh against their impressive strengths? That's the key judgment.
Okay, so we've thoroughly explored the business model, the market dynamics, Nicolas Correa's competitive edge, their incredibly strong financials, their ambitious growth plans, and now the key risks they face. So what does all of this mean for Nicolas Correa's valuation? Does the market truly appreciate this company's demonstrable strengths? Or is there maybe a disconnect between its intrinsic quality and its current share price?
This is really where the story becomes a compelling puzzle, I think. And it's a central question for any potential investor. The market currently assigns Nicolas Correa a valuation that appears to be at a significant discount to its industry peers, despite its demonstrably superior financial fundamentals. This disconnect between what looks like a high-quality business and its comparatively lower market price is really the central point of the investment thesis here.
Interesting. What do the specific numbers say about that? How is it currently valued on traditional metrics, like PE or EBITDA?
Right. Looking at current and historical valuation multiples, the stock trades at a trailing 12-month, or TTM, price-to-earnings ratio, PE, of approximately 9.5x. Now, this multiple has historically been quite volatile, ranging from over 17x back in 2017 to a low of 6.2x in 2022. That volatility is pretty characteristic of a cyclical business where earnings can fluctuate significantly.
Okay, 9.5x PE now, but it moves around. What about EBITDA?
Their TTM enterprise value to EBITDA, which, as you know, is often preferred for industrial companies, as it strips out the impact of debt and non-cash items, is currently in the range of 5.8x to 6.3x. This places it toward the lower end of its own historical range, suggesting it's not currently overvalued relative to its past performance.
Okay, so the current valuation isn't historically stretched for them, but how does that compare to their competitors, especially given their superior margins and that fortress balance sheet you described?
That's precisely where the significant discount becomes starkly evident. Analyst reports consistently highlight that Nicolas Correa trades at a substantial discount to comparable machine tool manufacturers pretty much across the board.
How substantial?
Well, for example, their forward EBITDA multiple is estimated around 4.5x to 5.0x. That is significantly lower than the peer group average, which typically hovers around 8.1x to 8.4x.
Wow, that's almost half, a 40-50% discount.
Yeah, we are talking about a considerable 40-50% discount to its direct competitors on that key metric. Similarly, their forward PE ratio is roughly 7x to 8x, which is about half the peer average of around 15.5x.
That's a huge gap. It really makes you wonder, doesn't it? A company with demonstrably higher profit margins, remember, 14-15% EBITDA projected versus around 10% for peers operating with a net cash balance sheet and generating strong returns on capital with a ROCE of 17.7%. You would typically expect such a business to trade at a premium, not such a large discount. Why do you think there's such a persistent disconnect between their operational quality and their market valuation? What's the market seeing or maybe not seeing?
It truly is the core analytical challenge here, and it might suggest a market blind spot. A business with Nicolas Correa's financial strength and competitive positioning should, by conventional financial wisdom, command a higher valuation. The market's concerns likely center on several factors we've discussed. Its relatively smaller scale compared to the global giants that can lead to lower stock liquidity, less attention from large institutional investors.
Less visibility.
The concentrated family ownership, while creating strong alignment, can also deter some investors who prefer more diversified governance structures or maybe fear less influence as minority shareholders. And critically, The market is undoubtedly pricing in its high exposure to that weakening European market. That's the immediate and tangible headwind.
So Europe is casting a long shadow.
It seems so. These factors might collectively lead to a more cautious market assessment, even if the underlying fundamentals are exceptionally strong. It's a question of whether those factors justify the size of the discount.
Okay, so given this intriguing valuation gap, what could potentially change the market's mind? What could lead to a re-rating of the stock, closing that significant gap you described?
Several potential catalysts could drive a valuation re-rating for Nicolas Correa, I think. Firstly, just sustained performance. Continued strong execution, the successful completion of their ambitious capacity expansion program on time and on budget, and the consistent maintenance of their superior profit margins, especially through any cyclical downturns, that could compel the market to recognize the company's true quality and resilience over time.
Proving the doubters wrong through results.
Exactly. Secondly, successful diversification. Particularly demonstrating tangible success in the Indian market and effectively expanding into other emerging economies would reduce the perceived risk associated with their European concentration. Thirdly, a broad-based cyclical recovery in the European industrial sector would alleviate the market's most immediate concern, likely leading to improved order intake and sentiment.
A rising tide lifts all boats.
It often does. And finally, simply increased visibility. Greater coverage from financial analysts or increased institutional investor ownership could bring more attention to this compelling financial story, leading to a broader appreciation of its strengths. It's also worth highlighting again that built-in margin of safety provided by their net cash position, it's around 1.56 dirhams per share currently. That represents about 15% of their market cap, essentially providing a hard asset floor for a significant portion of the stock price. That's quite rare and offers some downside protection.
That cash cushion.
Yeah. What's truly fascinating here is the market's apparent skepticism, despite the company's clear and verifiable strengths. While its smaller scale and concentrated ownership can indeed deter some larger institutional investors, the disconnect between its exceptional operational quality and its valuation multiples is significant. If we connect this to the bigger picture, it suggests that for you, the curious learner, who is willing to look beyond immediate headlines and deeply understand underlying fundamentals, there might just be a compelling and potentially overlooked story here, waiting to be fully appreciated by the broader market.
Okay, as we start to wrap up this really comprehensive deep dive, for you, our listener, who might be curious about tracking a company like this, or maybe just applying these insights to understanding industrial cycles, what are the most important metrics to keep an eye on going forward? And let's quickly revisit some of those core questions we set out to answer at the very beginning, just to crystallize the takeaways.
Absolutely. The most critical leading indicators for Nicolas Correa are definitely order intake and backlog. These are the forward-looking metrics that give you the best sense of future revenue. A sustained book-to-bill ratio above 1.0x, meaning they're booking more new orders than they're fulfilling signals, continued strong demand. Remember, at the end of 2023, their backlog was a record 107.7 million with a book-to-bill ratio of about 1.2x.
So watch if that stays above 1.
Exactly. You'll want to diligently monitor the evolution of these figures in their quarterly and annual reports. Second, their EBITDA margin is paramount. Tracking the company's ability to sustain that superior profitability, that 4 to 5 percentage point advantage over peers through various economic cycles, is crucial. Any significant compression of this margin would be a potential red flag, indicating challenges maybe to their pricing power or cost control.
So watch for new orders coming in and keep a very close eye on how profitable those orders actually are. What else should we be looking for in their financials as they execute this growth plan?
As they deploy all that significant capital into their capacity expansion program, return on invested capital, ROIC, will be the key metric to judge the success and efficiency of those investments. The goal is to maintain ROIC well above their cost of capital, which they currently are doing. A consistently high ROIC indicates that their investments are genuinely creating value for shareholders.
Making sure the spending pays off.
Precisely. Finally, free cash flow, FCF generation, will be important to monitor, particularly over the next 2 years, while capital expenditures are elevated due to their expansion. A swift and strong return to robust FCF generation after the expansion completes would be a very positive signal, showing their ability to convert those profits back into deployable cash.
Okay, very clear metrics to track. Let's quickly recap and reinforce some of those core research questions we set out to answer. First, how well positioned is Nicolas Correa to benefit from the growing manufacturing reshoring trends globally?
Exceptionally well-positioned, I'd say. As a high-quality, technologically advanced European manufacturer, Nicolas Correa is a reliable and geographically proximate alternative for Western companies looking to de-risk their supply chains, bring production closer to home, away from maybe more distant or geopolitically sensitive regions. This reshoring trend directly stimulates demand for their advanced, versatile machine tools.
Okay. What about their exposure to the aerospace and defense spending cycles? Is that a significant driver for them?
Aerospace and defense is absolutely a key end market for them. They are very well poised to benefit from the surging demand in commercial aviation, those record order backlogs. And concurrently, global defense spending continues to climb due to ongoing geopolitical factors. Their targeted focus on the Indian defense sector, as we discussed, represents a tangible and strategically important growth vector within this high-value segment.
How effectively has the company adapted to the pervasive digitalization trends, Industry 4.0? Are they keeping up?
They've adapted very effectively and proactively, it seems. Their active participation in leading Industry 4.0 R&D projects like MIL IoT for connected machines and their involvement in the Regional Smart Specialization Strategy, RIS3, demonstrates a clear and tangible commitment to delivering smarter, integrated, data-driven manufacturing solutions. They appear to be actively shaping the future of intelligent machine tools, not just reacting.
What are their key technological differentiators that set them apart, especially when facing competition from, say, Asian low-cost manufacturers? What's their edge?
The primary differentiator remains their proprietary high-performance milling head technology, most notably that patented UDX head. This unique component offers difficult-to-replicate precision, speed, and flexibility that low-cost competitors simply cannot match. This core technological advantage is powerfully complemented by their long-standing brand reputation for robustness, reliability, and precision, that crucial trust factor.
How sustainable are their current high margin levels through various economic cycles, especially if we see a deeper downturn in Europe? Can they hold on to them?
Well, while peak margins for any industrial company may face some pressure during a severe economic downturn, there is strong evidence suggesting Nicolas Correa possesses a structural margin advantage over its peers. This seems rooted in their significant pricing power, derived from that technological differentiation and strong brand. It's further supported by disciplined cost controls, and crucially, that growing high-margin after-sales service business, providing a stable base of recurring revenue.
Okay. What is the company's capacity for international expansion, particularly in high-growth emerging markets like India? Do they have the chops for it?
They've demonstrated both the strategic intent and the tangible capacity for international expansion. That $1.5 million investment in the new service hub in Pune, India, along with their stated willingness to explore full production facilities and potential joint ventures there, clearly signifies a flexible, ambitious, and seemingly well-resourced approach to tapping into critical high-growth emerging markets. It looks like a serious commitment.
How does their innovation pipeline specifically position them for future growth and continued relevance in a fast-changing world?
Their innovation pipeline appears robust, well-defined, and strategically aligned with key industry trends. Their R&D efforts are heavily focused on critical areas like digitalization, proactive maintenance, eco-efficiency in machine design, and the ability to process advanced materials. This ensures their products remain technologically relevant, helps them command a premium price, and directly secures future growth by meeting the evolving needs of advanced manufacturing.
And finally, what are the key operational leverage points in their business model? How do they manage to grow profits faster than revenue when things are good?
The primary operational leverage point really stems from the high fixed cost nature of their manufacturing operations. When revenue increases and their production facilities operate at high utilization, those significant fixed costs, think factory overhead, R&D, admin expenses, get spread over a much larger volume of units.
Economy of scale kicks in.
Exactly. This means that each additional unit of revenue contributes a disproportionately higher amount to profit, causing earnings like EBIT and EBITDA to grow significantly faster than revenue. It's a powerful multiplier effect when demand is strong and capacity is fully utilized. If we connect all this to the bigger picture, for you, the learner, it really highlights the immense importance of not just looking at a company's past performance, but deeply understanding its strategic positioning against both powerful long-term secular trends and immediate cyclical headwinds. It also emphasizes the critical role of disciplined capital allocation and the impact of strong governance on long-term value creation. It's a complex interplay.
And that brings us to the very end of our deep dive into Nicholas Correa essay. What an insightful journey, really, into the sophisticated world of these mother machines and the strategic choices that allow a highly specialized niche player to not just survive, but truly thrive on the global industrial stage.
Yeah, it's a fascinating case study. And this deep dive into a company like Nicholas Correa raises, I think, an important question for you to consider. In a world increasingly driven by digital advancements, virtual realities, intangible assets, what enduring value do you see in the tangible, high-precision capital goods that literally, physically build our modern world? And looking forward, what might be the next truly disruptive innovation in this foundational, yet often overlooked, industrial sector? What comes after the UDX head?
A really profound thought to leave you with, indeed. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the hidden bedrock of industry. Until next time, keep learning, keep asking questions, and keep unpacking the fascinating world around you.